Today, we are going to move into our fourth week, Lewis, the Positive Apologist. And I should probably just say right off the bat what I mean by that, the Positive Apologist. The word apologist is an interesting word. It doesn't mean to apologize. It means to give an account or defense of something. And it actually comes from 1 Peter 3:15 is, I think, where we kind of biblically ground this. I won't read the Greek for you there, but you can see that, well, we can, but we won't do that. But you can see that that little red word there, there's three movements. There's a red, a blue, and a green movement in 1 Peter 3:15. But set apart, hagiasate, set apart Christ as Lord of your hearts, always being ready to make a defense. And do you see that blue word there is apologion, okay? Apologos, a word towards or for. Okay, it's the idea of defending something, all right? Ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and respect. And that's the third movement. So look at this. You have this, it starts with worship, setting apart Christ as Lord in your hearts. Some people want to be apologists. The first step, if you want to be an apologist, is worship. Get yourself in a local church and become a worshiper. And that's how you'll set Christ up in your hearts as Lord, right? It's an act of worship. And then the next step is then be ready. Be ready to give an answer, right? Be ready to say something. Rehearse what you know why, because people are going to see. When you start worshiping Christ and living for Christ, people should see something different in your life. And then the next thing is going to people might ask some questions. What's going on here? Be ready for that. And then the final step, I love this. As you do that, it's not enough to convey information. Be aware of your listener. Be aware, and there's a certain, these are posture words, right? These are words of posture, but they're also a certain recognition of who, recognize who you're talking to. And I really think this third one is the one that Lewis was the master of. Lewis had a way of respecting his audience, of speaking to them as if they are very intelligent people, because they were, and he took them very serious, and was very, and just was very gentlemanly and civil. Man, if the church needs anything today, we need to be civil. If we can't be civil, we look just like our culture, which is tribalized. So that's where we get the word apologetics, right? It's from this 1 Peter 3:15, and it has these three movements. And so we're going to be talking about what it looks like to, what we get from Lewis, actually, not what it looked like, what we get from Lewis in terms of this. But I also say Lewis as the positive apologist. Now let me explain what I mean by this. I don't mean that Lewis was upbeat, that he was friendly, that he was a glass half full kind of guy. Okay? What I mean by this is I mean that Lewis gave arguments for, in the plus sense. Okay? So positive in the sense of positive versus negative. So he gave arguments for God's existence. Now there's Lewis is not the first, of course, right? You had Aquinas's five arguments for God's existence. I think Peter Kreeft on his website has 20 arguments for God's existence. I recently came across an article that went through 36 different arguments for God's existence. If you believe in God, the good news is there's a lot of positive arguments for God's existence, okay? If you don't believe in God, you kind of have only one argument, and we're going to talk about that next week, all right? All right? That's your one thing you really can work with, okay? So come back for that. But if you but if you believe in God, there's all these arguments for God's existence, and they explore those in this class here often. So he was positive in the sense that he would give arguments for God's existence, and we're going to look at three of those today. But positive also in the sense of addition. In the sense of addition, Lewis added to the field of apologetics. Lewis actually is credited with inventing some new arguments. Now, I'm going to contest that a little bit. Sorry, C.S. Lewis fans. I think that what he really did is that he took things that were floating out there and he brought them together in that third sense of 1 Peter 3:15. He brought them together in such a compelling way that it felt like new arguments. But if you understand the history of these arguments, you'll see that they've been around before. But Lewis was the master. He was the master at bringing something new to something we already knew. Right? He was a master at that. So remember, Lewis is writing during the middle of the 20th century, and it's a time when naturalism, the philosophical idea that nature is the whole show, it's all that there is, naturalism is huge. Nowadays, at least in North America, people like to say that they're spiritual. That means they're open to nature having kind of non-material elements. Maybe nature also has a spiritual element or something like this, something nebulous like this. But this is Lewis is writing during a time where you have like cold, hard naturalism that means materialism. In the sense of materialism, like matter is all there is. And so we're going to see that Lewis's primary thrust of his apologetics really is aimed at this naturalism, at this materialism. And so today we're going to look at three arguments that Lewis gave in order to go after this kind of naturalism while at the same time suggesting that there is a God. And what are those three arguments? Here's the three arguments we're going to look at. The first argument is the argument from morality. And we kind of began to stumble on this last week when we were talking about Lewis's ethics, but we're going to develop that today and pick that up from last week. The second argument is the argument from rationality, the fact that we actually have reason. And then the third argument is the argument from desire, which oftentimes Lewis is credited with as a new kind of argument. Peter Kreef says that. And so we'll look at that as well. And then we're going to conclude by taking a look at what I think is the most important character trait that Lewis had as a positive apologist. So that's where we're going this morning. Let's start by talking about the argument from morality. And with each one of these, I have a little book that is one of the primary resources where Lewis presents this. There's other resources as well. But the argument from morality is really developed in Mere Christianity. As we saw last week in The Abolition of Man, he gives an argument for morality, but it's not connected to theism per se. Okay? But in Mere Christianity, he takes what he said last week, what we talked about last week, and he shows how this kind of moral impulse that we have seems to point to God. So remember, last week we saw that Lewis rejected the belief that emerged in the Enlightenment and became accelerated with Nietzsche, that ethics are merely a human product emerging from culture, reason, utilitarian purposes, instincts, etc. Rather, according to Lewis, morality, that things are actually right and wrong, is an a priori given that comes by virtue of our humanity. It's part of our operating equipment. It's part of humanity's fundamental way of being in the world, in the same way that the laws of logic are part of our fundamental operating equipment. I mean the fundamental laws of logic, like law of identity, excluded middle, non-contradiction. These are fundamental to even being able to give meaningful statements. So Lewis wants to say that that right and wrong is something that comes with our humanity, but he makes another claim, even more surprising. He says that right and wrong is something that we see across cultures. It's a transcultural thing. People use oughtness language in every culture. Lewis writes, if anyone will take the trouble to compare the moral teaching of, say, the ancient Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Hindus, Chinese, Greeks, and Romans, what will strike them, will strike him, will be how very, very like they are to each other and to our own. So Lewis not only says that oughtness language is transcultural, he wants to say the kind of things that we're saying when we use oughtness language is very similar. We looked at this last week when we looked at The Abolition of Man. So Lewis, in the back of The Abolition of Man, talks about the Tao, okay? And this is this kind of moral body of knowledge that you see operating transculturally. Things like the law of general beneficence towards people, things like the law of special beneficence towards family and friends, duties towards those who came before you, like parents and elders and ancestors, and duty towards children and posterity, and the law of justice and veracity and magnanimity and so on, that there's this kind of universal inheritance of moral values that you find. So you don't, Lewis is not the kind of person that thinks that only Christians have truth. Lewis recognizes that other religions, other worldviews have truth in them. What Lewis wants to say is that Christianity is the summation, it's the clearest presentation of all truth. It's the fullness of that truth. Lewis writes, the human mind has no more power of inventing a new value than of planting a new sun in the sky or a new primary color in the spectrum. And yes, that is a British spelling. Some of you, this has been really hard for you, okay? Believe me, I've been back and forth between here and Europe, and like after a while, you see it all over, like, you know, but when you first start doing this stuff, you're like, they're misspelling stuff. They're using weird punctuation. And I've kind of struggled as I've thrown these quotes up here, like, am I going to give you the British? Am I going to give you the English? I go back and forth, too. It's not consistent. I'm sorry. Okay. So as we saw in The Abolition of Man, Lewis argues that although children should be trained in an ethical assessment that helps the students with practical reasoning, and that's what used to be moral reasoning, help them with practical reasoning, we don't see that happening anymore. We have a split between values, and values are seen as just things that are relative to each person, and then there's kind of the cold, hard facts, right? And so Lewis develops this idea that right and wrong, it doesn't develop, but he shows how right and wrong transcends culture. And he does this before becoming a Christian. We talked about that as well. Remember that? Now, in Mere Christianity, Lewis pulls from this development that we saw last week, his ethics. And now he's going to pull from this the Tao, this idea that there's this shared body of moral knowledge, that there's this oughtness that people can't help but speak, right? You ought not to do that. Hey, that's my chair. You ought not to take that. Hey, I was in line first. What are you doing? That doesn't just happen in North America. That happens around the world all the time, okay? This oughtness that we speak, and he's going to show that, he's going to make a connection and say that this kind of weird feeling we have that there's a right and a wrong is really, it makes sense if there's a God, okay? Now, notice how I said that. I didn't say that you have to be an idiot to not believe in God. Clearly, there are some outs if you don't want to believe in God, okay? The way I like to present my faith when I'm doing apologetics is I say, Christianity makes sense of the world as it comes to me. If you've got something better, I'm open to that. There needs to be a certain epistemic humility is what we call it. There needs to be a certain humility about how we are as knowers, especially in our fragilized secular culture, where the person on your living to your left and to your right is someone that has a very different view of the world. And we all know that. Everybody's looking over their shoulders today. Everybody. If you're an atheist, you're looking over your shoulder because you know, well, that guy's believing over there. If you're an agnostic, you're looking over your shoulder. Everyone's looking over their shoulder. So recognizing with humility that Christianity isn't just a slam dunk and insulting people, right? 1 Peter 3:15, with respect, right? With genuine kindness and respect. But Lewis states that we can't help but constantly appeal to standards of behavior, and even a professed relativist, if someone steals their seat, will feel indignation at the violation of moral code, you know? And at our church, we don't try to get on into bipartisan debates because we think the gospel transcends bipartisan debates. We think that the moral vision of Jesus transcends any particular political construment that will ever be made in any political environment anywhere in the world. But I will say this, if you watch Fox News or you watch CNN News, what you will hear is you will hear moral indignation. It doesn't matter which side you're on. And Lewis would say, exactly. And that, my friends, is an argument for the existence of God, whichever political side you're on. Lewis says this can't be reduced to moral instincts. We went through this because moral instincts compete with each other. We inevitably appeal to some higher standard to say which instinct we're going to go with. And we can, and Lewis writes, human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. In this particular case, there's something above and beyond the ordinary facts of men's behavior, and yet quite definitely real, a real law, which none of us made, but which we find pressing on us. Now think about this for a second. What kind of thing does a value exist in? Does a value exist in a rock? Does a value exist in time? Values exist in minds. Minds and values go together. So the fact that we have this kind of these kind of constant value judgments, and we don't appeal to them in ways that are just like, well, I'm just making this up. This is just might makes right. We're appealing to other people in a way that shows that we believe that there's a standard that sits above and beyond both of us. That's my seat. Well, tough luck. I'm bigger than you. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's some standard of right and wrong that we both should be adhering to. Now, when you make that claim, the question is, well, where does that standard come from? Because a standard of right and wrong is something that would exist in a mind. So this is where Lewis is going to go with this. Lewis says it's more than just descriptive. When men say, I ought, they certainly think they are saying something and something true about the nature of the proposed action and not merely about their own feelings. But if naturalism is true, I ought is the same sort of statement as I itch or I'm going to be sick. What's the difference between those statements? I ought, that's a statement of oughtness. I itch is a statement of isness. And this is the great problem. How do you go from isness to oughtness without some kind of standard that transcends both parties, right? That's the problem that Lewis is showing. So Lewis then goes and moves and says that this seems to point against naturalism towards a religious view of the world. What is behind the universe is more like a mind than it is like anything else we know. That is to say, it is conscious and has purpose and prefers one thing to another. And then Lewis from here, if you've read Mere Christianity, goes on and shows how pantheism doesn't work. And we can't go into all the details, but with the problem with pantheism, if you want to say that the world is God, then in many ways, the world has lots of things. The world has beauty and goodness and acts of kindness and charity, but the world also has ugliness and rape and, you know, tooth and claw and blood. And so the world seems to not care about right and wrong. It just has both. It seems impervious from that. So when you identify God with this world, the problem with monism, the view that God and the world are one, is that you're not able to have this kind of rich sense of right and wrong. Lewis then goes on and says, dualism won't work. Maybe there's two equal and opposite powerful gods. And this at first sounds good, but if good and evil are powers that are equally strong, how do you say which of them is the good one? Better to say the universe was created by a good God, but evil came into it, Lewis says. And that's exactly what Christians believe. The universe was created by a good God, but then evil came into it. I mean, how scary would it be to be like just sitting here between equal and opposite gods that are fighting it out? Neither of them's going to win. And what are we? We're just like the guinea pigs watching, you know, watching World War, I don't know what, bazillion? I mean, this is equal and opposite gods, not just human beings. So Lewis writes, these dualism and pantheism are not going to work. Let's see here. The trouble is that one part of you is on his side and really agrees with his disapproval of human greed and trickery and exploitation. You may want him to make an exception in your case to let you off this one time, but you know at bottom that unless the power behind the world really and unalterably detests the sort of behavior, then he cannot be good. So Lewis says, it's not only a problem out there. See, the battle is in here. Everybody that we know who uses oughtness language doesn't live up to their own oughtness language. Implicit in there is the recognition that there's a need for a savior. Tim Keller, one of my favorite preachers, says it this way. He says, imagine somebody followed you around. Tim Keller's been so immersed by C.S. Lewis. When you hear him preach, you can hear him using Lewis's logic. How many of you have seen that before? I'm like, oh, that's Lewis. Oh, that's Lewis. And by the way, incredibly effective in reaching urban Manhattanites in one of the most post-Christian places in the world. So Lewis still has traction if we can continue to enter into the way he does this. But Tim Keller says, imagine somebody follows you around with a little video recorder. They can see all your thoughts, everything you're doing, and that's going to be projected. Now, there will certainly be things we're like, oh, right? We don't live up to our own standards. Things we ask other people to do, everyone knows that. So this is the terrible fix we're in. Lewis writes, this is the terrible fix we're in. If the universe is not governed by an absolute goodness, then all our efforts are in the long run hopeless. But if it is, then we are making ourselves enemies to that goodness every day. So our case is hopeless again. We cannot do without it, and we cannot do with it. God is the only comfort. He is also the supreme terror, the thing we most need and the thing we most want to hide from. So this is how he sets up. It goes against naturalism, sets up belief in God, using right and wrong. Let's look at another argument that Lewis uses, the argument from rationality. As I just stated, Lewis lived during a time when naturalism was on the rise, and that is the belief that everything can be accounted for as part of the natural world, and we don't need any other explanations. And Lewis points out that naturalism is a very vulnerable viewpoint. It's a very vulnerable viewpoint, because all you need to do is show the existence of one thing that does not exist by virtue of nature to refute naturalism. Just one thing. You already pointed to one, this weird sense we have that there's some kind of law that exists outside that we all adhere to. But Lewis is going to point out more than one, so he's going to point out to another one right now. But he says this, any one thing makes good a claim to be on its own, to be something more than an expression of the character of nature as a whole, then we have abandoned naturalism. For by naturalism, we mean the doctrine that only nature, the whole interlocking system, exists. And by the way, Lewis likes to capitalize words, which is very similar to German. And I kind of like it. I don't know if you have learned German before, but Yeah, mein Deutsch ist schlecht. Yeah, but you know, with German, you can just capitalize nouns that you really want to accent. I love that. There's some things we should learn from other. Maybe we can, like, you know, in Holland, they have a national meeting every year where they revise the Dutch, and the entire country watches it on TV. And like the rules this year, and we're changing this. They're very progressive with their language. In France, they have the Ministry of Foreign Language, where they preserve the French language, and where you can be fined for using English words. So very different approaches. So I don't know what the American approach is. But Lewis, I think, favored the German for some reason, or he likes to capitalize things. So just as Lewis argued, our practical reason, that is moral reasoning, our moral sense, is unable to be explained via natural causes, instinct or utility, etc. In a similar move, Lewis argues that our theoretical reason could not be the result of the accidental unfolding of events within a closed system of nature, but rather must be derived from a source outside the world of state-to-state causation. Now, in order to understand this, we just need to think a little bit about Darwin. You know, Darwin held that thinking was not itself a matter of normativity, but the result of impersonal forces. Darwin wrote, "Shake 10,000 grains of sand together, and one will be uppermost. So in thoughts, one will rise according to law." Now, Darwin was uncomfortable with his own view. Darwin never felt good about it. Darwin felt it worried him. He realized that he might be in some way undermining the trustworthiness of reason itself. And if you undermine the trustworthiness of reason itself, you better stop talking. Right? And so Darwin recognized this. After all, Darwin realized that evolutionary advantage has no necessary relationship to rational thought. Evolutionary advantage has no necessary relationship to rational thought. And in fact, we can imagine some scenarios where it might be more advantageous to do something that is not rational at all. In fact, we see that happening all the time in the animal kingdom. This illustration shows us why Lewis's claim, if nature is all there is, that we live in a closed system of state-to-state causation, if that's all we have, then philosophical and scientific statements verge on being meaningless, including the statement that naturalism is true. And he develops this in his book, Miracles. In a chapter that's called The Cardinal Difficulty of Naturalism, Lewis unfolds this conclusion. Lewis explains, we can understand how feelings of pleasure and pain may be the natural byproducts of evolution, but reason is a very different kind of thing. Reason is a feeling of certainty that moves beyond cause and effect, moves beyond isness to ground and consequent oughtness. Okay? So we can't confuse thinking with pain and pleasure. These are very different kinds of things. Lewis writes, all possible knowledge depends on the validity of reasoning. If the feeling of certainty which we express by words like must be and therefore and since, that's what you do if you're doing, God help you if you are, but if you're doing symbolic logic, right? And I took a class on this, and praise Jesus, I did not go into that. But I almost did a PhD in analytic philosophy, and Jesus rescued me. But if you go in for this stuff, you know what I'm talking about. If you go in for this stuff, you know, you have all these equations. But then you say, you know, well, you know, you maybe deductively, well, this then therefore must be this. Or therefore, we conclude, or since. See, listen to that language. So Lewis says, if the feeling of certainty which we express by words like must be and therefore and since is a real perception of how things outside our minds really must be, well and good. But if the certainty is merely a feeling in our own minds and not a genuine insight into realities beyond them, if it merely represents the way our minds happen to work, then we can have no knowledge. Because that kind of language of logic has to have correspondence in the outside world. Now, we can understand why deductive logic, okay, which doesn't correspond, it's a priori, it doesn't correspond to the external world. We can understand why deductive logic is problematic in terms of it being a feature of evolution, because it's not connected at all. You know, so if you say, you know, what is deductive logic? You know, all triangles have three sides. You know,
This thing has three, this object has three sides of the triangle. Something like this, right? Where you're deducting from the definition down to what some conclusion. Versus inductive, where you're pointing things out and then you're coming to conclusions about it. So deductive is this has always been a problem, but Lewis here is pointing to the inductive problem. The inductive problem is that we have certain kinds of assumptions taking place in our minds about what's happening. And it seems to point to, again, it seems to point to something outside of naturalism. Our reasoning beliefs are related to each other so that one belief makes evident or provides reason for accepting another belief, as Lewis says. Reasoning here is based not on state-to-state triggers within the brain, but abstract principles that lie outside the system of nature. When we engage in such reasoning, our conclusions are not mere physical experiences and observations, but more like entering into a supernatural realm of eternal oughts, a real outside temporal sensation and cause of cause and effect, a real ground and consequent. In other words, and this is a huge subject. We're not going to solve all this right now, okay? David Bentley Hart wrote a really phenomenal book called The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, and Bliss. There's a really good podcast, by the way, that it's up right now on the podcast Unbelievable. You may ever listen to that podcast. And he's arguing with Raymond Tallis, who's an agnostic. He's arguing that clearly, I can't make sense of our consciousness as a purely naturalist, through a purely naturalistic worldview. I don't know what to do with that. I'm not going to become a Christian, but I don't know what to do with that. And then David Bentley Hart's like, I know what to do with that, right? He's like, let me tell you what to do with that. Well, Lewis knew what to do with that. In an essay called Living in an Atomic Age, Lewis writes, if the sciences teach us that our minds are chance arrangements of atoms, then there must have been some mistake. For if that were so, then the sciences themselves would be chance arrangements of atoms, and we should have no reason for believing in them. And then Lewis writes, there's only one way to avoid this deadlock. We must go back to a much earlier view than naturalism. We must simply accept it that we are spirits, free and rational beings, at present inhabiting an irrational universe, and must draw the conclusion that we are not derived from it. We come from somewhere else. Nature is not the only thing that exists. Reason rests on abstract principles that lie outside the system of nature. It's not the result of mere physical experience and observations. So if you got lost right here, let me just give you an illustration. Okay. Let's say that you are entering Sierra Madre from the 210, and you see up on the mountainside SM. Okay. And you see these rocks forming these letters. And imagine also that you're a geologist, and you actually have compelling reasons, because you know about the local geology, to believe that these rocks were formed through a random process, a volcanic eruption. You know this. You're a geologist, okay? But as you drive towards the rocks and you're looking for Sierra Madre, lo and behold, it takes you up Baldwin Avenue, and you end up in downtown Sierra Madre. Is there a downtown? I don't know. What is this? It's the center of the town. And even though it turns out that these rocks were sitting above Sierra Madre, it would be unreasonable for you to trust in them as a sign. They're just simply the result of accidental processes, state-to-state accidental processes. They're not a sign. They're not communicating. Knowing they're the result of a random process means it's wrong to think of them as a sign in the first place. And if our brains are simply the result of random accidental processes, why do we hold them to giving us truths about the world? It doesn't make sense. Alvin Plantinga, who's a philosopher at Notre Dame, a name like Plantinga. See, now I know all this stuff. Plantinga is Frisian. Plantinga, Walter Storff, all the great Christian philosophers come from Friesland. My doctoral mentor, from Friesland. Friesland is in the Netherlands and Germany. But Alvin Plantinga, they're hardy farmers and they come over here and then they become great philosophers. So Alvin Plantinga, Notre Dame, argued the most important Christian, he's arguably the most important Christian epistemologist. He was offered the chair of philosophy at Harvard. That's kind of a nice thing to be granted, He draws from Lewis's argument from reason and several others do as well. I think David Bentley Hart is drawing from it too in his book on the experience of God. So you can read more about that. All right, let's go to our third and I think the most interesting argument that Lewis gives for God against naturalism.
And this is arguably the most original contribution to the study of apologetics that Lewis gave us. And it's Lewis's argument from desire. As I already said, philosopher Peter Kreef states that next to Anselm's famous ontological argument, Lewis's argument from desire is, quote, the single most intriguing argument in the history of human thought. Thanks, Peter Kreef. I think if you're sitting around and, you know, if you're excited by Anselm's ontological argument, I'm not really sure it gives me much, you know, street cred if you think Lewis's argument for desire, because the argument's super abstract. But that's okay, Peter. Anyway, it is a really compelling argument. And I actually feel like more than any other argument that Lewis gives us, this one has the most power. I think this one is so important. And it's actually something that's come up again and again in the history of Christianity. But Lewis took it, and again, remember, Lewis is writing during the height of Freud, right? 40 years after Freud, everyone's inspecting themselves and trying to understand themselves. Good thing, right? But Lewis here is paying attention to what's going on inside. And before becoming a Christian, we already saw this. Lewis was kind of a Freudian atheist, right? He thought that religion was wish fulfillment. That's what Freud taught. So to get to this argument, we really should kind of, like we just started, to get back into Lewis's autobiography. And I have four books up here, you know. See that? Four books. And it's hard to pick. But in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, Lewis says the central story of his life is really about his pursuit of joy. It's really about his pursuit of joy. And if you remember from our first lecture, Lewis the Man, we described how, again and again, Lewis came up against this intense longing, this overwhelming desire for an indefinable numinous. Numinous means something beyond your grasp. Numinous something that was he just couldn't quite get. As a child, he encountered it when his brother Warren showed him a toy garden made of moss and twigs arranged on the lid of a biscuit tin. Biscuit means cookie. He encountered it when he read Beatrix Potter's Squirrel Nutkin, a reading that troubled him with, quote, the idea of autumn. He encountered it when his eyes suddenly caught the words, I heard a voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead. Lewis writes, I knew nothing about Balder, but instantly I was uplifted into huge regions of northern sky. I desired with almost sickening intensity something never to be described, except that it is cold, spacious, severe, pale, and remote. And then, as in the other examples, found myself at the very same moment already falling out of that desire and wishing I were back in it. In his narrative poem, Dimer, right? This was this big, long poem. You can read it. And this is a really beautiful book that just came out, I think 2007, The Poetry of C.S. Lewis. It's the complete poems of C.S. Lewis. But this giant narrative poem, Lewis, this is before he's a Christian, writes, can it be possible that joy flows through and when the course is run, it leaves no change, no mark on us to tell its passing? And as poor as we've begun, we end the richest day. What we have won, can it all die like this? Joy flickers on the razor edge of the present and is gone. So he was wrestling with this deep, deep sense, and he called it joy. In Pilgrim's Regress, remember that's the first book he wrote once he became a believer. In Pilgrim's Regress, joy is symbolized by the island, okay, by the island. Pilgrim's Regress begins with John, who has this vision of this island, okay? Now, Pilgrim's Regress, it's playing off of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, right? And in Pilgrim's Progress, what happens there? Well, in Pilgrim's Progress, Christian's journey begins when he has this clear vision of the gospel of Christ. But in Pilgrim's Regress, it begins when there's this clear flash of joy that comes with this glimpse of this distant mystical island. And it fills our pilgrim with sweetness and pang. So he abandons home and family to seek the object of his desire. So it's very Dante-esque. If you've ever read the beginning of the Divine Trilogy, Dante starts trying to climb the hill of heaven, but then he gets sidetracked by the leopard of lust, right? He gets sidetracked. And in the same way, in Pilgrim's Regress, Lewis begins trying to pursue this joy, this vision of joy, but he gets sidetracked. He gets sidetracked by the brown lady, which is like lust, and he gets into art, you know. And if you read The Great Divorce, you see a lot of people that are sidetracked, a lot of damned ghosts. I like saying that in church because we can get away with it because it's true. They are damned ghosts. A lot of damned ghosts that have become sidetracked.
There's this theologian in hell, in the Great Divorce.
This theologian in hell
who's fallen in love with theology but has left Christ behind. Scary, but true. Believe me, if you do academic theology, those programs are filled with those people, right? You meet artists that fall in love. At first, there's a glimmer of joy. They pursue art. There's something that they get captured by something. But once they get in it, they just get mucked and weighed down in it, and they forget why they even began.
And so this is what happens with John. He listens to beautiful music. It gives him pangs. But with each listening of beautiful music, the joy recedes. And if you read Pilgrim's Regress, which I highly recommend, you'll just see how Lewis, his whole journey is attempting. It's an allegory. His whole journey is attempting to get to this joy, and he just gets sidetracked by lots of things.
Describing joy, Lewis states, "It is an unsatisfied desire which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. I call it joy, which is here a technical term and must be sharply distinguished both from happiness and from pleasure. Joy, in my sense, has indeed one characteristic and one only in common with them, the fact that anyone who has experienced it will want it again. It might almost equally well be called a particular kind of unhappiness or grief, but then it is a kind we want."
So joy is this feeling that points beyond itself. If you try to capture it, to control it, to enjoy it as an end in itself, it vanishes. It oftentimes sneaks up on people when you're least expecting it. Kind of like Lewis's conversion, right? He was taking a ride to the zoo, and he finally found joy when he least expected it. It sneaks up on you when least expect it, and then if you try to capture it, it eludes you. Lewis sometimes called this feeling Sehnsucht, the German Sehnsucht. Yearning or wistful longing. From at least the age of 6, romantic longing, Sehnsucht, had played an unusually central part in my existence. Such longing is in itself the very reverse of wishful thinking. It is more like thoughtful wishing. Is your head exploding yet? Lewis writes, "I'm quite ready to describe Sehnsucht as spilled religion. Provided it is not forgotten that the spilled drops may be full of blessing to the unconverted man who licks them up, and therefore begins to search for the cup whence they were spilled. For the drops will be taken by some whose stomachs are not yet sound enough for the full draft." Well, there's the British spelling. Draft, a draft. That's like a pint of beer, right? A draft. So, yeah. And this is where I'm in deep agreement with Lewis. Lewis makes the claim that everybody you meet has a witness from God. Everybody you meet has had some kind of experience with joy. Maybe they just when they least expect it. Something that's opened their mind out, that there's something bigger, some fullness. In Charles Taylor's giant magnum opus, A Secular Age, he has a whole chapter on the fullness that people are searching for in our secular age. That fullness is Lewis's joy. The belonging in the universe. There's something that, I'm Reformed, so I believe that people are as conflicted as Lewis said. When you talk about God, it's both the most exciting idea and the most terrifying idea. Remember Lewis's first conversion? It was a miserable conversion, because now he actually had to live up to some kind of, he had to agree there's a moral standard. He didn't know if that God was a Christian God or a Hindu God or what, but, you know. So people are conflicted, and everybody we talk to is conflicted because everybody is made in the image of God and has a witness, I believe. All right, so what is Lewis doing here? Lewis is developing Augustine's fundamental insight in the Confessions that our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. And in an age of Freud, whereas Augustine's Confessions argues that lust is a sublimation of love, the earth is crammed with heaven, in the age of Freud, Augustine's argument is undone, claiming that love is a sublimation of lust and heaven is merely wish fulfillment. So in a signature move, I think Lewis saw this, in a signature move, Lewis inverts the modern view being established by Freud in his day, arguing that human desire for heaven is not a projection from below, but an incarnation from above. And that the deeper the sexual love, and that sexual love is wistful longing, I'm sorry, what do I have here? And that deeper than sexual love is the wistful longing or joy. Sehnsucht. That is the deeper thing. That is the deeper desire. That below, and people, you know, people that give themselves over to sex at some point just come to a place where it's like it's empty. There's something deeper I was looking for. Or food. Or you name whatever good thing it is, you know. I know the Cineglues just went to French Laundry. I hope I'm not outing them. But I mean, that's. I mean, I saw that. I went to touch Georgina today. Like, can I have some of the glory? Like, French Laundry, serious. If you're a foodie, I'm not. But if you are, you know, you never know what might happen if you go to French Laundry. But, you know, there's no desires in this world that ultimately are going to be it for us. This is what Lewis is doing. Lewis is flipping Freud on his head. It's a very Lewis-esque thing to do. Lewis writes, joy is not a substitute for sex, but sex is often a substitute for joy. All right, so what is the argument from desire? Here is the argument. Let me give you the argument, and then we'll bring the horses into the stable. Lewis's feeling of joy is the basis of his argument for desire, and the argument goes like this. Every natural or innate desire in us have corresponding real objects that can satisfy these desires. Let me say that again. Every natural or innate desire in us have corresponding real objects that can satisfy these desires. We experience thirst, and lo and behold, there's something called water. We experience a natural innate desire for food, and there's something called food. For sex, and there's something called sex. Beauty, and there's such a thing as beauty in the world. Now, of course, having this desire doesn't guarantee we're going to actually get the thing we're desiring. You could be, you know, alone on an ugly, deserted island, you know, and without any food or water. Tough luck, okay? But it does suggest that there is something, there seems to be this correspondence between our natural desires and the things we find in the world. Lewis writes, the Christian says creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. Now, here's the second part of the argument. Lewis then goes on and says, there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, no creature can satisfy. Okay? So, every natural innate desire in us has a corresponding real object that can satisfy these desires. And the second point is, but there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, no creature can satisfy. This was joy, right? This was the thing that kept drawing him in. He knew it wasn't, he couldn't contain it or capture it. It was beyond. Lewis writes, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Made for another world. At the conclusion of his reflections on the Psalms, Lewis notes how we have a desire to be reconciled with time. He writes, we find that always aching wound, which mere succession and mutability inflict on us. If we are so little reconciled to time that we are even astonished at it. How he's grown, we exclaim. How time flies. As though the universal form of our experience were again and again a novelty. It is as strange as if a fish were repeatedly surprised at the wetness of water. And that would be strange indeed, unless, of course, the fish were destined to become one day a land animal. I like how Lewis, like, uses evolution to argue against naturalism. So, yeah, it's really good. It's very clever. So here we are, right? Here we are. I mean, and now this is like one of these pieces, right? That we're creatures that are uncomfortable with temporality. We find ourselves in a position where, and this was Augustine's argument in Confessions chapter 11, that time has fallen. That we are constantly in the process where the past is always behind us, the future always looms, and all we have is a succession of moments in the present that we can't hold on to. And this is life. And as soon as you try to grab it, it's gone. It's in the past. And the future is coming. But you can't have the future and you can't have the past. You just have this, grasping. And Augustine says, in heaven, the fallenness of time which places us in this constant state of disequilibrium, being surprised continuously. I mean, how many of you look in the mirror and you're surprised? Who is that guy? right? That we were meant to be reconciled with time. Or as Ecclesiastes says, that God has placed eternity in our hearts. We were made for a different way of being, and we intuit it. When you go to a funeral, there's something that's like, this story should not end. Right? When you have moments of joy and belonging in the universe, you think, I want more. When you're in worship and you have those rare moments where you sense the presence of God, you know this is what you want more than anything else. The psalm says, one thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord. That's joy. So Lewis says the real problem is when you meet an unbeliever is that they're out of touch with their desires. In an age of Freud, where people believe that at the core we are libidinal impulses, and that to not allow somebody the right to pursue what those libidinal impulses are is to deny them of humanity. What that does, Lewis would say, is that creates people that are shooting too low. They're just shooting too low. But that's what we have. I used to speak at Long Beach City College. I would come in as a representative of Christianity. So they'd have different religions, representative of different religions. So I was Christianity. I was mere Christianity. I'm like, you poor people. I would give a talk, try to give a compelling talk for Christianity. I would use a lot of Lewis. I would end with some Lewis. And then open up for questions. I'd be giving arguments for, you know, Kalam, cosmological argument, whatever. I mean, I'd just come out of an apologetics program. I was good. I was ready. Let's go. Number one objection, always out of the gate. If what you're saying is true, does that mean I can't have sex with whoever I want to? Listen to what's behind that. Behind that is a statement about what human beings are and what fullness in life looks like. And you know, the answer is, maybe your life is meant for something deeper than that. Maybe there's something richer than that. Maybe your lust is not the ultimate aspect of your humanity. Maybe you were meant for joy. I hope so. I hope that for you. Lewis writes, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. I love this. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he can't imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea. We are far too easily pleased. So Lewis, I think, I mean, one of the reasons why I think he was so good with his argument from desire, though I don't think he's the first one to give us that, but the reason he was so good is because Lewis was in this, he had this combination of being both a rigorous philosopher and someone that was engaged in English literature and knew about the imagination. He was a poet. He understood the power of beauty. He understood persuasion. He understood the third aspect of 1 Peter 3:15. That you need to, when you approach people in conversations, you need to take them absolutely serious. And he did. And you need to present things in a way that isn't just raw facts. Jesus didn't come just to give us raw facts. Jesus lived this beautiful life. He gave parables. He said things in profound ways. He dropped nuggets that then would go off days later in the mind of somebody. You know, and Lewis did the same thing. So Lewis doesn't invent the argument from morality, and the argument's gone on. It's moved on. There's other people that are, I think, doing a better job, maybe. He didn't invent the argument from reason. He didn't invent the argument from desire, but he presented them in ways that were powerful. He clarifies them. He gives them a certain kind of traction. And he did the same thing with what he's well known for, but it wasn't his. George MacDonald, The Everlasting Man, talks about how we have to face up to the reality of who Jesus Christ is that the Gospels present.
And a lot of people, especially during the middle of the 20th century, where we have theological liberalism floating in, well, it's already taken over Europe at this point, but coming in from America now, where Jesus is just a good moral teacher. And Lewis then had a really powerful way of taking from George MacDonald and saying, that's we can't accept that. He says, a man who is merely a man and says the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You can shut him up as a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us. He did not intend it. 1 Peter 3:15. Worship. Be committed to your local church. The first step, if you're going to be an apologist, is to have your heart transformed by Jesus Christ on a daily basis. Participate in the ordinances the Lord gave us, the bread and the cup, the word. Number two, get ready. Because if your life has changed and people see something going on, they're going to ask you questions. And then number three, pray that you will have the kind of brilliant, thoughtful kindness to listen carefully and respond in an intelligent way, filled with beauty and grace, as we see in C.S. Lewis. Thank you. At this time, we're going to have a little bit of Q&A. And it's not going to last long because we do have a congregational meeting in about 15 minutes. So,
okay, first question is from the online audience. Creation asks, does our post-truth context where feelings are perceived as equally valid or equally as important as facts lead to a kind of inductive reasoning whereby people arrive at moral arguments of what is the good? Is this a mechanism by which would be thoughtful individuals create that unum necessarium while still believing that they are engaged in making something of a new moral?
Can you read that again, please?
All right, we'll try this one more time. Does our post-truth context, where feelings are perceived as equally valid or equally as important as facts, lead to a kind of inductive reasoning whereby people arrive at moral arguments of what is the good, quote unquote?
That's true. I think that's true. I'm in agreement, if I understand this correctly. I'm in agreement with that.
Okay, what's the second half of this?
Okay, the second half is this a mechanism by which would-be thoughtful individuals create that unum necessarium, and I think I'm saying that right, while still believing that they are engaged in making something of a new moral?
Oh, I love it. I love the question. I mean, it's really a statement, and I agree with the statement. It's a statement about what happens in an age of expressivism, where, and Lewis goes after this in The Abolition of Man, where the ultimate goal is not really truth, that there is some kind of thing out there that is outside of ourselves, right? But the goal is for us to, and I've said this before, the goal is for us to reach deep inside within the cavern of our own subjectivity to see what it is that we feel and to bring that forward faithfully. And if we do that, that's the one thing we need to do to have truth. But that's ridiculous. Okay, that's just ridiculous. But that's the age we're living in, right? Because you can reach deep down inside and decide that you're a giant caterpillar that needs to crawl on the floor, and you're just like a weird dude crawling on the floor. You're not a caterpillar, no matter how deeply you feel you're a caterpillar that needs to crawl on the floor. But this is, I think that's a brilliant, kind of an insight more than a question, I think. So, why don't we go right here, and I'll just restate your question, then we'll get this one. Yes?
The word Tao, does it come from Eastern religion? Where did Lewis get that?
Yeah, it just means the way, and it's used in both Confucianism and Taoism, but it just means the way. It's helpful that it's not just connected to one particular religious system or moral system, and I think he did that intentionally because he didn't want to confuse it with saying that he's signing off, say, like signing off on the Torah or, you know, maybe on, you know, the Quran or something like that. So, yeah, it just means the way, and it's
He did the same thing with German, right? So he's using English languages, right? And he wants to say that there's a law that we're all holding to, but then he'll pull in from another language to show that what he's talking about is universal. So Lewis was a linguist, so he knew lots of languages he could pull from. Good question. Thank you. Yes.
I hope I can remember my question. I was watching what used to be called the Military Channel on cable TV. It's now called the American Heroes Channel. And they had a documentary series listed there under DVR. And it was entitled The Evolution of Evil. And so I watched one about Gaddafi, and I watched one about Mao. And it seems like Mao kind of a lot of people epitomizes evil, because like his main philosophy was the end justifies the means.
Mm-hmm.
And cruelty, taking things by force, that was the norm for him. And I'm wondering how Lewis would respond to that. Obviously it's fallacious reasoning, but how would he immediately, or maybe not immediately, but how would he contradict that?
Yeah, and you don't need just Mao. That's Machiavelli, right? That's where that kind of, he's the first person to talk about realpolitik. And Nietzsche is the one that just kind of embraces it, you know, and says, well, weakness is no virtue, and if you're weak, you just need to be, good luck, power is, being the Übermensch, being the strong one. But I think that Lewis would say that this is an incredibly scary thing, yeah. Right? I mean, this is the mark of hell. The mark of hell is where we approach each other purely in terms of power relations. I heard one time it said that the difference between heaven and hell are both places where people have no arms. In hell, people starve to death. In heaven, they've learned to feed each other with their feet. You see? And I think Lewis would agree with that. Lewis would say that really the vision of the Trinity, which we talked about when we talked about Lewis the theologian, that there's this eternal fellowship of persons in loving, giving, and receiving, that is what is ultimately real. And the problem with Mao, and the problem with Pol Pot, and the problem with Hitler, and the problem with all these despots that we see that have this might makes right, is that they're out of sync with reality. Reality is people in deep, loving communion. And if you refuse to be in sync with reality, then you will be quarantined, Lewis would say, because reality will go forward without you. And so Lewis would want to say hell is a quarantine, where we take people that refuse to be a part of the dance of the Trinity, and we allow them to live in their solipsistic, individual hell of loneliness, instead of the fellowship and the communion that God invites all of us into in the Trinity. So, yeah.
Regarding the argument from morality,
yeah,
my understanding is that he argues that there are some morality that is universal and therefore outside ourselves. And the example is the seat first or not to lie. But aren't there communities that do have moralities that are different than that, such that there's a community that might believe that lying is not wrong, mm-hmm. or that you can take the seat? And if so, does that destroy mm-hmm. Lewis's argument about universal morality?
Yeah. So Lewis has two things he wants to say. He wants to say that it's part of the operating equipment to make oughtness statements, and that if you look at the actual content of the oughtness statements, there's something called the Tao, which is certain kind of laws or certain kinds of standards that seem to be held universally. And Lewis does address these kind of exceptions. And if I remember correctly, one thing he says is that the exceptions actually, a lot of the exceptions aren't really exceptions. They're just different applications of the same law within a different cultural context. That's one way Lewis, whether or not you think he does it satisfactory. But then Lewis would also say that not all cultures are equal. And some cultures are more fallen than other cultures, right? And so I think he would handle it that way.
But isn't that just circular argument? Well, it's not universal, but that's because it's fallen. I mean, isn't that just the same argument around again?
It's not universal, but it is fallen. I think it is. Help me understand how that's circular.
So you're saying it's universal, and here's an exception.
Yeah.
But that's not really an exception, because that's just a fallen culture. Then aren't you just arguing on yourself?
Yeah, I see. Yeah, so Lewis would want to say that we hold based on the vast, so it's an inductive argument. So if you see if you see most sheep are white and then you find one black one, then I think you can still hold to this idea that sheep are kind of white creatures, but that occasionally there's something in the gene pool. I think it's what Lewis would say. Again, I'm not here to defend Lewis. He comes from a natural law tradition. I come from a common grace tradition. So I actually have an entirely different way in which I would articulate this. But I do believe that Lewis is right, that in terms of his fundamental impulses, that human beings have an oughtness and human beings have certain shared moral content. I'm just less optimistic about our epistemic equipment for getting to that because of the fall. It's part of me being a Calvinist, which is like a bad word these days, but I'm deeply appreciative of what Lewis does. So yeah. So yes.
On the question from that listener, facts and feelings. Do I understand that we ought to trust our feelings?
Well, I can't answer for the listener, but if you're asking me, I think that there are times to trust your feelings. I think that the feelings are very important. I don't think to say that there's a difference between expression and expressionism. So there is a place for expression. If you're doing art, please express, in your art, If you're sharing what you feel, if you're sitting down with a therapist, you need to express what's going on. So there's nothing wrong with your feelings. There's nothing wrong with expressing that. We're not against feelings here. The Psalms are filled with feelings, all kinds of feelings. The problem is when the only way of knowing becomes your own self-assessment of what's taking place within your emotional life, then I think that's a reduction. And rather than something that's more full about the way we know. I don't know if that's helpful. Yes?
That's why I personally think that today's self-talk is terrible, because when I talk about myself, I talk about myself to my pastor. I don't talk about myself to the universe. But a lot of people feel the self is the most important thing. No, it's not. God is the most important mm-hmm. thing. And I believe in the Holy Spirit's leading
mm-hmm.
because the Holy Spirit led me here. Today is rainy Super Bowl Sunday, traffic-filled Super Bowl Sunday, and that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
I did not go to church today on top of a great big steep hill with revelers off to their game parties.
Well, I hope to be a reveler at one point during the day, but I will say... But I will say, it is a work of the Holy Spirit that we're here on Super Bowl Sunday. Like, hallelujah to that. So, yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. Yes, one last question, then we need to break because we have a congregation meeting.
I'm trying to apply the moral argument to a huge moral dilemma that we are embroiled in here, and that is the sanctity of life versus the quality of life. And... I recently counseled a young woman at the pregnancy center about whether to have an abortion or not. And I appealed to her not on sanctity of life, but on her quality of life, because that seems to be the more compelling argument. And I think that's why we have this huge divide, because most of modern society is thinking in terms of what's good for me,
mm-hmm.
not in terms of what is good.
Yeah.
In terms of God.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to approach that, in the realm of apologetics and in practical life, how to reach out to those who have defined good as what I need or what I want. Mm,
yeah. It's a very tricky thing, counseling somebody with a decision like that. And oftentimes, people that are in crisis have imploded within themselves all they can see is their own fear and pain. And so we need to pray for you. It's a really difficult thing. I don't know if I have a word for you about that, but it is, and sometimes it's just kind of too late if somebody hasn't had the capacity to develop moral reasoning. There are consequences when they actually face, and Lewis talks about this in The Abolition of Man, that here you have these children that are reading this book, and it's inserting this idea that there is no such thing as objective morality. There's just feelings. And once you've removed the tool of practical reasoning from a young person, when they actually face real issues that have massive consequences, that's been stripped from them. And it's been stripped from in our culture. And here you are in this situation attempting to help somebody in this situation to have more than just a voice of my own experience or expression. And even then, you're trying to work what's called an immanent critique, where you work within the logic of what you do have, right? Because sometimes that's all we can do, is work with, if it's too late for someone to grasp a way of thinking outside of their particular world, then the next step is to move into the world and see if there's some way in which we can offer an immanent critique. So thank you so much.